Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be concluding the book of Ezra today, and it concludes in a very funny way. It seems to be a very legalistic, prejudice closing. But you know, in context, it's not really that at all. It's just when we read our culture back into their culture, and that's a problem with biblical interpretation at all points. We must let it speak to us in its day without forcing it to fit into our day and our norms. This has been the passage that's usually proof text for people who are against interracial marriages. But this chapter has nothing to do with interracial marriages. I've done a tape a few weeks ago called Interracial Marriages. You might want to send for that. I think you might be surprised. So much of what we believe does not come from the Bible, but comes from our cultural denominational interpretation of proof-texting the Bible. And that's totally inappropriate. Now, Ezra does close in a surprising way. And yet, when you see it in context, it's not so surprising at all. Let's look then at Ezra chapter 9. Now, when these things had been completed, there's been much discussion about those who do commentary work on Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah, because they are very similar in style and vocabulary, how they relate. And the reason is this. In the book of Nehemiah, we have Ezra speaking in the first person, beginning in the latter parts of chapter 7 and going through, I think, chapter 10. It seems to be the personal memoirs of Ezra that are out of place in Nehemiah. And many scholars have said they fit beautifully between chapters 8 and 9. So some think now concerning these things is really Nehemiah 7:73 through 9:37. We have no manuscripts that support that theory, and Ezra and Nehemiah in the Jewish literature is one book. It seems to be a compilation from the memoirs of Ezra and the memoirs of Nehemiah, edited by either Ezra or another person. Some people call him the chronicler. Now, I'm not sure about exactly the theories of how the Bible got put together, but I'm sure of this. The Bible is the Word of God. Who finally put it together is not as important, is that God is his author. So I'm not certain if Ezra 7, latter part of 7, 8, and 9 fit here. But now concerning might try to refer to chapter 8, verse 36. Because there's a 4.5 month period between when Ezra arrives and when he's told about these mixed marriages. And the theory has been, it's very surprising that in 4.5 months he wouldn't have known this for himself. Well, many people think that he was gone in this early few weeks to give these official credentials from the king, or Xerxes the First, to these government officials in the province beyond the river, which is the technical name for Syria and Palestine in the Persian Empire. Now, notice where it says, the princes approached me. The word princes is used in Nehemiah for local officials, and that may, tribal elders is kind of the idea. The people of Israel, notice it's not Israel and Judah anymore, it's the combined people of God. And the priests and the Levites. Now, this seems to be the three groups of society. You might want to see over in chapter 10, verse 5. The priests were one group. The Levites were the priest helpers in the temple. And they were the teachers of the law. The priests were those who produced sacrifice. And then the people. So it would be the laity and the teachers and the sacrificial clergy, if you please. It's kind of the three groups here. Had not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands according to their abominations, those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. Now, this is a very interesting verse for two reasons. These people no longer existed as a racial group, but this is the Deuteronomic phrase for them. Well, really, it's the Pentateuchal phrase. It's the Mosaic phrase. You see it so clearly in Genesis 15, about verse 16, calls them the Amorites, and later in chapter 15, they're all seven tribes of the Canaanites are named. We see it in Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 4. We see it in Exodus 34, 11 through 16, these different groups named, but they are no longer in existence. So you see, we're going back to the ancient covenant pattern to set the appropriateness of the post-exilic period. And so what it's saying is we're trying to base our community on the words of Scripture. That's what they're trying to do. Now, the word Hittites These are the folks in central Turkey. For years, we didn't have any documented evidence of their existence except in the Bible. Many folks said, well, obviously the Bible just made them up. And then suddenly we found a library containing 2,000 years of documented history of the Hittites. Every time archaeology makes a new find, the Bible's historicity is affirmed. Now, the word Canaanites, it was the general term for the people of Palestine. It means lowlanders. Amorites were also a general term for the people of Palestine, and it means highlanders. And if you look at a map of Judah, we're talking about the low Judean hills where the Amorites lived, and what's called the Shipla, or the coastal plain, where the Canaanites lived. Now, the Jebusites were the people who inhabited Jerusalem before David conquered it. Now, the Ammonites, these are not mentioned in the original list here. They seem to be the descendants of Lot. So Moab is also the descendants of Lot through the incestuous relationship with his daughters. Now, Moab, notice that in Ruth 4:15, Ruth is a Moabitess who Boaz marries and becomes the line of the Messiah. My goodness. Now, Egyptians. Now, Egyptians have never really been approved as marriage partners. Matter of fact, if you have to compare this these prohibitions against foreign marriages with Deuteronomy 21:10 through 14, which seems to allow foreign marriages. So there seems to be an ambiguity here. But for Ezra, he's really pushing one part of the equation because of the religious condition of the post-exilic period. And I'll give you that more in just a minute. Now, I want to tell you some of the folks who married these foreigners. I just mentioned that Boaz married Ruth, a Moabitess. I want you to know that Solomon married an Egyptian in 1 Kings 3:1. That marriage is never condemned. Matter of fact, Jewish tradition says she became a proselyte. Joseph married an Egyptian in Genesis 41:45, and that's never condemned at all. Moses married not only a foreigner, the daughter of Jethro, and that's in Exodus 2:21, but Moses married a black lady, a Cushite, in Numbers chapter 2, verse 1. And you ought to see, is that 2? Can't read my own writing. I think it's 12:1. I write so little, it's hard for me to see. And David married a foreign lady in 2 Samuel 3:3. So here have been some precedents about foreign marriage. So it's not so much that they were foreigners that was the problem. It was the religious problem. You see, here was Israel put back in the land. Now, she had been kicked out of the land because she took on the idolatries of the natural inhabitants. And now, by marrying these foreigners again, and it seems to be out of two reasons, either they were well established and had land, and these Jews wanted some part of that land inheritance, or they were afraid of the inhabitants of the land, because if you go back to Ezra chapter 4, verse 7 through about 23, you see the problem of the Jews being exclusive and the people who live there getting mad at them. So why, I don't know, but they did marry them. Now, the reason it was so bad is, by marrying these foreign women, these foreign women brought their religious training into this new Jewish home, and the children were not pure Yahwehist. And that had always been the problem. That's why the exile occurred, this syncretic tendencies among the Jewish people. And so here they were getting right back into the very sin that caused them to be exiled in the first place. And that's why Ezra throws a theological fit right here. It was not the racial identity, it was the religious training. Now, if they became proselytes, I think that's why chapter 10, there's such a small number of cases compared to such a long court hearing. I think some of these women had converted. Some of them had brought their children up in the nurture and admonition of Yahweh. And those were not forced to divorce, but only those who were still pagan, I think. Now, for they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has been intermingled with the people of the land. Now, when you see that holy race, you think, ah, racial purity. The Jewish people have never been racially pure. Just go back and look at the lineage of Jesus in Matthew and Luke, and you'll see all kinds. Rahab, the Canaanite harlot, tradition says she is in the line of both Joshua's children, and later in Jeremiah. Now, we can't prove that, but she's obviously in the lineage of the Messiah. Wow! Now, we're not sure that's the Rahab, but it's maybe, probably is, could be, I don't know. But I'm saying, you look at Ruth in there, she's a Moabitess. So this holy seed is not so much racial, but theological. Now, This same phrase, not exactly, but the same idea is seen in Genesis 28:14, Exodus 19:16, Isaiah 6:13, and Malachi 2:15. There is an exclusiveness in the Old Testament, but it is primarily the choice of God in His revelation, not just the racial blessings of Abraham. And we're going to see where that is really true in the New Testament, especially Ephesians chapter 2 and Galatians chapter 3. Now, so when I heard about this matter, and notice verse 3, I tore my garments and my robe, I pulled some of my hair from my head and my beard, and I sat down appalled. Now, these were all signs of mourning. Usually the Jews shaved their head. Here he plucked them out. That's unusual, but it's a sign of mourning. To tear the outer garment was a sign of mourning, and here to sit down was a sense of shame. We see it again in chapter 10, verses 1 and 6. Now, in verse 6, at the end it says, "Gather the exiles to me, and I sat appalled." Now, the Hebrew word here is fasted, but it's obviously not long enough to be considered a fast. So a set appalled is the idea, but the word is fast. Until the evening offering. Now the morning sacrifice was about 9 a.m. and the evening sacrifice was about 3 p.m. By Jesus' day, the Pharisees begin to fast at 9, 12, and 3, connected with these two morning and evening sacrifices. Okay? But at the evening offering, I rose from my humiliation, even with my garments and robe torn. I fell on my knees. Now I will tell you, and stretch out my hands. Praying, the normal posture of Jewish prayer is the hands and eyes lifted, standing. So when you see anyone kneeling, it means an intensity, like Daniel kneeling toward Jerusalem. When you see Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane prostrate, that's even more intensity. So here is a very intense prayer in the normal mode of Jewish praying. Now for this hands outstretched, let me give you a few references. Exodus 9:29, 1 Kings 8:22, and Isaiah 1:15. Now, here's the prayer of Ezra. The prayer of Ezra in chapter 8 and the prayer of Nehemiah in the opening of Nehemiah are very similar to the prayer of Moses and Daniel. Okay? This is what they're going to do. They're going to start out, Oh my God, I am ashamed and embarrassed to lift my face to thee. It's I-centered. But it's going to move immediately to we're or our. So he is going to identify himself with the sinful covenant community because of the Hebrew concept of corporality. It's the theology of the remnant restored. And he is a part of that remnant. Though he did not personally sin, he is caught up in their sin. Look at the ours and we're and us all the way through here. Now, for our iniquities have risen above our heads and our guilt have grown to heaven. And this is the idea of the terrible sinfulness of what they're doing, okay? Our fathers have sinned, and we've sinned. That's the general idea here. When it says they have been given into the hand of the kings of the land, we could go back and do a quick historical survey. Tiglag-Pileser, Salmaneser, Sargon, Esarhaddon, Pharaoh Necho II, Nebuchadnezzar II, all took some of the kings of Judah and Israel into captivity. And it's a fulfillment of this. Now notice it mentions in verse 8 and in verse 9 a cultural metaphor that's somewhat hard for English translators to catch. When it says, have us an escaped remnant, there's the covenant promise of the restored temple, the restored divinic leader, the restored land. A peg in this holy place. Now the word peg is a nomadic metaphor for a place to put their tent, a dwelling place. Now, in the latter part of verse 9, it says, a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. Now, it's obviously not a wall around all of Judah. It's another metaphor here. This word means an owner's rock wall. So what God's saying is, I've given you ownership in the promised land. I've given you a secure place in the land of inheritance. That's what these two metaphors mean. Now, notice it mentioned verse 11. Which thou hast commanded thy servants, the prophets, saying. Now, there is no quote exactly of what he's going to say. It's a summary of a lot of the prophets. But I want you to notice, this was not an overreaction to a minor problem. This is not a reaction to interracial marriage. It's a reaction to the major problem of idolatry among the Jewish people that's starting all over again in the very same pattern that it started over again in the first place. And a classical example would be Jezebel and Ahaz, okay? Let's see now. Notice in verse 15, he continues to pray. He's moving toward the focus of his prayer. When he says, O Lord, notice the covenant name for God, Yahweh. O Lord God of Israel, thou art righteous. Now, the word righteous usually means a standard or a straight edge used for God's holiness. But here, the word seems to be used in a very common derivative, meaning gracious or kind to us, okay? Look at the latter part. Our guilt, for no one can stand before thee. I want to tell you, history has a moral element. Now, many folks don't believe that, but I want to tell you, God has built into his world some moral principles. And God's people are responsible for them in individual and in a corporate sense, both. It's only in Ezekiel and Jeremiah that the individual focus of the corporate aspect of Israel's sin and salvation comes to the forefront, especially in the New Covenant. Now, in chapter 10, while Ezra's deep move, sense of guilt, moved the other people. This wasn't a play acting on Ezra's part. He was deeply moved. Ezra comes across in his book as a very sincere, godly man. Now, the other people are moved. They said, oh, we have sinned. Oh, this is true. Maybe they didn't realize it, but they had done it. So in chapter 2, one of them, one of the people who in chapter 10, verse 26, was guilty of taking a foreign wife, admits this and says, we've got to get this thing corrected. Now, in verse 5, Ezra arose and made the leading priests, the Levites, and all Israel take an oath that they would do according to this proposal. The proposal of the man in verse 2 of putting away their foreign wives. But there was a lot of complication here, and it couldn't be done immediately. And so they decided to have everybody gather in 3 days. Okay? In verse 6, he goes to one of the chambers of a man named Jehoahan. Now, this has been one of the proof texts of those who say that Ezra and Nehemiah are not contemporaneous, but are sequential, with Ezra being after Nehemiah. And they use this high priest's name as a proof. Now, this is a very common high priest name. It would be like Bob Smith or something. So we cannot use this as a proof. It is an evidence that there is some technical dating problems in these books, but we can't use it for an evidence for a later date for Ezra. Excuse me. Now, notice what it mentions here. Let's see. Verse 8 shows one of the powers that Ezra was given by Artaxerxes I, and that was confiscation of property. Now we'll see chapter 7, verse 26. Notice in verse 9, it mentions the ninth month. This is the Kislev. It would be midwinter. Now, the reason I mention this is the people gathered in 3 days, or else they'd lose their house. And it was raining. It rains a lot in midwinter in Palestine. They were afraid of what Ezra was going to say, and they were cold and shivering from the cold. So here they are trembling, both from fear of Ezra and exposure. So Ezra mercifully gives a short sermon and very wisely says, let's wait a few months, get this thing done right. We'll set some local officials to judge these people, and we'll take concern. Because we're putting away family and children, very painful thing. But they want to do it appropriately. You say, well, how can it ever be appropriately? Well, it's possible that these men, you might well see Malachi 2, 10 through 16, had put away their Hebrew wives to marry these foreign wives to gain some land inheritance. There was a dowry involved. There was some land inheritance involved. There were children and their property rights involved. And so they didn't want to be just wholesale and just put everybody away. Apparently, these women went back to their families. I don't know what else they did. Notice it says in verse 13, nor can the task be done in 1 or 2 days, for we've transgressed greatly in this matter. That's what the assembly is telling Ezra. Ezra was the kind of guy who let them feel a part of the proceedings. And so he appoints a commission, and they begin to study. And apparently they study and hold court in these local areas for 75 days. But in 75 days, if you look at the list in verse 18 and following, it's only 110 cases. I think many of the women became proselytes, and many of them were bringing their children up. And so I think there are many more cases of mixed marriage than this. But some were not required to go back because they were truly worshipers of Yahweh. I want you to notice in verse 18 that the priests are mentioned first. Man, we're not trying to hide anybody's warts. The priests had done it, the Levites had done it, and the people of the land had, all three groups of society. And even the high priest family, Joshua, under Zerubbabel, some of his kin had done this, and they're mentioned by name here. Genealogies are very important for these post-exilic people, both those who sinned and those who returned, because these genealogies are what's going to set who can marry who gets what land inheritance, who is really Jewish, who can be a priest, and on and on. And so we see more and more lists. These two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, are just filled with lists of family names. Okay? Now, notice where it mentions here in verse 19, they pledged. Now, the word they pledged is they gave their hand. This is very similar to our handshake, binding an agreement or saying hello. We see it several times in the Old Testament, 2 Kings 10:15, 1 Chronicles 29:24, 2 Chronicles 30, verse 8, and Ezekiel 17:18. Now, it mentions that the priests were required to give a guilt offering. Now, a guilt offering is referred to in Leviticus 5:14 through 26. And it was only for an unintentional sin. There was no offering for an intentional sin. So maybe these folks did not realize the major problem that was involved in marrying these foreign women. That's the implication. Now, whether that all of them had to offer a guilt offering, we're not certain. It is obvious that the priest had to offer a ram for a guilt offering. It's also possible the other ones had to also, but we just can't be sure. Now, notice in verse 25, the mention of all Israel again, which implies that the tribes are united. There's no sense of a separated kingdom, Israel and Judah. Israel here means the sons of Jacob, which it originally meant before the split in 922 between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Now, you can read through the names here. They're very similar to the list in Ezra chapter 2. They're very similar to the list that's going to occur in Nehemiah. There's just so many family groups that came back from the exile, and this seems to be a pretty good list of them. Now, pardon me, if you go to verse 44, this is very, very difficult in the Hebrew text. We're not real certain what it means. Matter of fact, it's so uncertain in the Masoretic text that Revised Standard Version of the Bible takes its text not from the Masoretic text, but from the apocryphal book of 1 Esdras chapter 9, verse 36. Now, all the way through here, we have said that 1 Esdras, which is not in your canon, is a very good historical book. And the names found in this apocryphal book sometimes help us find the true list that have been somewhat corrupted in the Masoretic text. That was true in chapter 2. So I want to say to you, I think some of the book of Maccabees are very good histories of the interbiblical period. And I think that the history can be trusted. It's not, we can't build doctrine on it, but I think I think it's 4th Maccabees or 2nd or 4th that's the good history. I want to say 1st Ezra seems to be an excellent, excellent parallel to Ezra and Nehemiah. As a matter of fact, sometimes it has the better reading, even better than the Septuagint, which of course is the Greek translation of the Old Testament done about 250 B.C. in Alexandria. So we're very grateful to God for some of the things that supplement the Scripture text. The Scriptures are inspired. There's no question about that. But being inspired does not help them sometimes from not being copied real correctly. And we have a number of manuscript dating and number problems in the Old Testament. Whenever we can find help from archaeology or these ancient translations or whatever, we're just grateful to God that we can catch the central truth of what he's trying to say. Now, Ezra has been a book. There's no miracles in Ezra. Ezra, God hasn't come down in a fiery pillar on the new temple or anything like that. And yet, it is a great example of a man of God trying to do the will of God as best he knows it. I don't think it's legalism on Ezra's part. I think it's faithfulness to the Mosaic covenant. I don't think we can take Ezra and Nehemiah and put it full-blown in our modern society without interpreting the central truths of the paragraphs and not just proof-texting certain passages. Ezra is such a big figure in rabbinical Judaism. I don't think those of us in Christianity understand the place Ezra fits. Ezra is really the one that rabbinical Judaism goes back to as the style setter of their worship. He is the beginner of the great synagogue. Most Jewish rabbis would say that Ezra is the final editor of the entire Old Testament. And the Old Testament we have and the Masoretic text would be from his hand. I think it is obvious that he is a godly man with a great love for God, trained in the Scriptures, living a godly life that's doing the best he knows with the life that he has. And he is trying to restore the covenant community. I don't think we can realize what a theological devastation it was for the community to be taken into captivity, the divinic king to be exiled, the temple to be destroyed. Every promise God made where he said, I will cause my name to dwell here forever. I'm going to set a king when David is thrown forever. No one will take this city. And then all those promises seem to be broken. Ezra is coming back and saying, just like Ezekiel after the fall. God's going to restore. It's important we get this little temple built. It's important we get the Jewish community back. Even though it's small, even though it's struggling, even though God's power is not here in the sense it was before, it is important that we are the restored covenant community. We must take on the characteristics of the Mosaic Pentateuch. We must look at our lineage and be truly Jewish, both in racial seed and in practice, for we are the inheritors of the promise. And that's what Ezra is all about. Next week, we're going to get in the book of Nehemiah, which is really one unit. And until 1488, in Hebrew Bibles, it was one book. It's been separated since then, but it's really one period, the post-exilic restoration of the people of God. I hope that you'll look at the commentaries I mentioned, the New International Commentary on the Old Testament and the InterVarsity Press Tyndale series. Those are two good ones. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. Thank you.